This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. At home this morning, I turned on the kitchen faucet and helped myself to a large glass of clean, cold water. You may have done the same thing. Did you think anything about that water other than it would quench your thirst? Chicago, on the shore of Lake Michigan, is looking into ways to conserve water and find new sources of water. Now, that's happening here. What's the situation elsewhere? Should we be concerned about water shortages outside our borders? We hope to address those questions and others this afternoon. Water is our topic. Our guest is journalist Jeffrey Rothfetter. He is the author of Every Drop for Sale, Our Desperate Battle Over Water in a World About to Run Out. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Jeffrey Rothfetter has reported on water issues for two decades for publications including The Washington Post and St. Petersburg Times. He is a former Businessweek editor and national editor for Bloomberg News. He also co-authored The People versus Big Tobacco and Privacy for Sale. His new book, Every Drop for Sale, is published by Putnam. Those telephone numbers, 333-9455. That's the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Jeffrey, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Here and abroad, who owns or controls water?
Well, it depends. But overall, water is a funny thing because it doesn't stick within its own borders. So in looking at it abroad first, most water supplies are controlled by, you know, three or four different nations because it travels through three or four different nations. The obvious is if you take the Mideast, for instance, where six nations all have access to the water in the Jordan River. And, of course, it's a desert, so there isn't a whole lot of water anyway. And right now, Israel happens to control the water. You know, in the United States, different states are fighting over water supplies. Southern California, of course, has no water of its own because it's a desert, and an irony we ought to get into in this discussion. But so they have to import their water from either Northern California or Colorado, the Colorado River, which of course is used by Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona. So you've got water doesn't stick with its own boundaries, and then you run into other issues where a lot of water supplies now are being privatized around the world and in the United States, which simply means that governments are giving up supplying water to people and telling private companies to come in and take control and supply the water, sometimes to good outcomes and sometimes to horrible outcomes.
Yeah. So we're treating water as a commodity.
Yeah. Water has become a commodity because we've never understood from the very beginning when we first built civilizations on the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and the first thing we did is build dams on it. We've never understood how fragile and how important water is to our lives. Ultimately, even though you know it intellectually, but we've never really felt it, and because of that, we've misused and mismanaged the water supply that's been given to us on Earth, and it's a limited water supply. It's all we got. What we have is all we got, and we're actually making less of it because of pollution, for instance, and because of damming, which slows down water distribution. And we've got a growing population in the world, obviously, which simply means that the law of supply and demand tells you we're actually running out of water. And according to some statistics that I quote in the book and people I interviewed, within the next 20 years, this is going to go from what is becoming a crisis now to a desperate situation.
Hmm. I mentioned Chicago in my introduction because it's so close to home. Chicago officials are awakening to a problem there on the shores of Lake Michigan. But Chicago isn't alone, and this was surprising to me to read in your book. Now, in Southern California, you expect a problem. But in other parts of the country, You know, I was really surprised to read about the difficulties people are facing because of water. Maybe you would tell us about the situation in Atlanta, which you talk about early in the book.
Yes. Atlanta is an interesting situation because there is another example of a state, Georgia, obviously, where the water that comes out of Georgia is shared by Florida and Alabama as well as it works its way towards the Gulf of Florida, actually. You know, obviously, all river water works its way back out to the ocean, ultimately. So that is really where the problem arises. So wherever the water starts, and in this case it's Georgia, it has to be shared with the other states. And if there's any change in the population or the development of the first area that gets the water, in this case Georgia, the areas downstream like Florida and Alabama are going to suffer. And in this case, Atlanta is the city that exemplifies sprawl in this country right now. You can read it in Tom Wolfe's great book, Man in Full, but that city is sprawling quicker than any other metropolitan area in the country, which simply means that, of course, as it develops, we need more water for the people that move in there. But not only that, as you take away the natural ground, the trees and the soil to build homes, to build factories for industry and so on, you then take away the natural aquifers, the place that the water resides and rests as it works its way slowly out to the ocean. And so with that, it begins to just rush out towards the ocean, which again slows the amount of water we can actually use for distribution. And so the combination of events in Atlanta, and again the sprawl and the development and the destruction of the aquifers, has meant that there's a water war breaking out between these three states, between Georgia, Florida, and Alabama, and they're all fighting over the same water supply. And at this point, again, within 20 years, and that tends to be what people are talking about now a lot, Atlanta will probably not have enough water to supply its growing population.
Hmm. I want to go back and ask you to expand on this idea of how water works and how aquifers are replenished over time. And that, because, unless you stop to think about this, it never occurs to you.
Right.
And I think that we're all guilty of that.
Well,
so,
yeah.
So sprawl gives you lots of pavement.
Right.
And the ground is not absorbing as much water as it used to, and you've got a runoff problem.
Right. And the, when you look at the rivers, and of course we're talking about freshwater, obviously, when you look at freshwater around the world and the rivers, there are so few rivers that reach the ocean anymore. I mean, you take some of the world's greatest rivers, like the Colorado River here in the United States is a perfect example, where about 2% of it ever gets its way out to the ocean. And that's the same all over the world and all throughout the United States, of course. Obviously the Missouri River in the United States doesn't reach the ocean anymore. And you've got great bodies of water like the Dead Sea, that don't reach the ocean, and so on. And the point though, that why that's important is this: what's happening is that the water is being used, is either being dammed and diverted, so it doesn't go its natural course anymore. And part of its natural course would be, again, to get into aquifers where it actually cleans itself. It's a cleansing process that makes sure the water remains clean as it works its way slowly towards the ocean and can be used by people along the way. That's the natural setup. So damming and diversion stops that process. Development stops that process. And obviously, pollution will also, of course, there are a lot of aquifers now in this country that are completely polluted. And so the water that ends up reaching the ocean is unusable by us along the way as well, which again lowers the amount that the aquifers can use. The aquifer system is really the basic system for supplying water to human beings that and animals, of course, that nature intended. And we've basically depleted in so many areas the aquifer system. Let me give you just one other quick example: the Ogallala Aquifer in which is out further west, which covers about 10 to 15 states, depending on little pieces of them, going all the way from the Dakotas down into Texas. It's a huge, huge aquifer in the plains. And we've now depleted that from, assuming it was 100% one time, it's now down to 12% replenishment rate at any one time, which means by the time the Texans get to use it, there's almost no water left in it. So that's just a good example. I mean, the aquifer replenishment rate in the world right now is at a very, very disturbing level.
Let's talk with a listener who's waiting for us on a cell phone on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I would just like to challenge his statement that the Missouri never reaches the ocean unless I've been real mistaken. There's a huge flow from the Missouri into the Mississippi just north of St. Louis.
Shut up
and listen.
Okay, that's fine. The Missouri, that's an interesting point. The Missouri is the most dammed and diverted waterway in the world. It's very interesting that Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark out to discover the Missouri, essentially, and instead what we ended up doing is this, beginning in 1829, which is just 15 years later or 20 years later after they went, we began to build huge, huge dams on the Missouri. And in fact, there's just a report that just came out this past week that if we don't restore the Missouri at least to some semblance of its earlier way of being, the Missouri will be a dead river before long, within 10 to 15 years. I didn't mean to say that none of the Missouri reaches the ocean, and yes, some of it gets into the Mississippi River, but the Missouri used to have its own course towards the ocean as well, which has now been completely shut off. And so the Missouri is an example, though, of the amount that's reaching the Mississippi, for instance, is not anywhere near what it was when Lewis and Clark first saw it and described it in the most incredible terms. If you ever read their writings about the Missouri, it almost makes you cry, because they talk about this as this incredibly this river with so many oxbows, and it just bent and it's rolled and it was wild and it was nasty. The Missouri is none of that now. The Missouri is a straight channel that is barely able to be used anymore.
And the Mississippi certainly is not without its problems.
Exactly. I'm not in any way arguing that we shouldn't have barge channels, and the Mississippi is obviously, the way it's set up in our continent, is the channel to bring to bring supplies in and out to the middle of the United States. But the key that I keep talking about, though, is we think we can control water, and we think we can manage water, and we really can't. And so instead of coexisting, and instead of figuring out how can we make it work so that some of water's rules also pertain, we end up trying to go by our own rules. And by doing that, here we are, 6,000 years after civilization began or something like that, And we're in this mess that we can't get out of that easily.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned, dams and irrigation and canals, mm-hmm. not without benefit. The answer to this question is yes. Can we do a better job in terms of achieving good results and avoiding damage? Where are we now? I remember that after the big Mississippi River flood of 1993, there were reports that water management techniques should be and would be rethought.
Well, yeah, and until we get to a crisis, we don't. And the problem with we're not building anymore. The Army Corps of Engineers, which is our major builder of dams, obviously, is not really building any more huge dams. I think in the United States, anyway, the era of huge dams is over. By the way, around the world, that's not the case. When you go to India, China is destroying the Yangtze River now by building six incredible dams, which will completely, not only is demolishing historical monuments, by the way, but also forcing the movement of millions of people out of their homes, all in the name of industry, supposedly. So huge dam building is still going on around the world. Egypt recently completed a huge project. But the United States, I think we're through with that. There is some effort afoot to restore some, as dams become obsolete, to just get rid of them, mostly smaller ones. And there is some effort to restore some waterways to the way they were. The classic example is the Everglades. In Florida, where there should be plenty of water, because the Everglades is probably the most incredible water plumbing system that nature created. It literally, you know, because it's a marsh, it will hold on to some of the water, deliver it when needed, ship some of it to the ocean when needed. Well, we just 50 years ago completely changed that, put a harness around the Everglades, and created a structure so we could deliver water to the Miami area, basically. Well, that has now brought Florida to drought conditions constantly. There isn't enough water now to supply the people in Florida, and there's constant water supply crises down there. So we're now spending $6 billion of taxpayer money to restore the Everglades to what it was like. That's going to take 30, 40 years, though. So we've destroyed it in 50 years, and we're going to take another 30, 40 to get it back. There are other places around the United States. If you think about the West, for instance, the Northwest, where, you know, the dams have obviously destroyed habitats for the salmon. Five of the major salmon species are on the endangered list, including the king salmon. That's purely because of dams. They can't get back and forth to the ocean, which, of course, is the way the salmon live. Some of those dams are being taken down, but not quickly enough. So, it is being rethought. That's a good way of putting it. But I don't see change happening as quickly as it should.
Journalist Jeffrey Rothfetter is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Every Drop for Sale, Our Desperate Battle Over Water in a World About to Run Out. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your telephone calls are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's go next to a listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi. Great topic. Historically, isn't this a problem going back to the rise of agrarian cultures, pretty much? I mean, doesn't the diversion of water and disastrous consequences, you know, go back almost 5,000, 6,000 years into the heart of agriculture?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, when you look at the usage of fresh water in the world, again, depending on the area, but let's broadly say that about 60% of the water, 60-70%, is used for agriculture, and about 10% is used for people, for our drinking and sanitation needs, and the other percentage, whether you take 10, 15, 20%, is used for industry. So clearly, agriculture uses the most water. And yes, you know, obviously when the first civilizations began, as I said earlier, they began to build dams, but they also obviously set up on the Tigris and Euphrates rivers because they wanted to set up irrigation ditches, and that was the beginning of it all. We have created a situation almost everywhere where the setting up of irrigation has destroyed either local water supplies or, again, habitats for fish. Just to harken back to the Northwest for a second, and this is true actually in the Northeast a lot as well with salmon, but in the Northwest now, you've probably heard of it, at Klamath Falls, there's an actual war broken out where people are fighting over, with guns, the dams that exist on Klamath Falls, mm-hmm. because some of the fishermen don't have enough salmon anymore to fish for. And the farmers, which only exist up there, that isn't farmland. It became farmland because of agricultural irrigation ditches that were set up. The farmers don't want to give up their water, and the industry doesn't want to give up their water. And so there have been actually, there was one guy arrested just about a month ago for shooting the dam. He was drunk in the middle of the night, but he was arrested for that. So you're absolutely right. That's where it all began, and it still is happening, and now we're beginning to see fights break out over it.
Well, and I think here in central Illinois, and God bless the farmers, I want to say that, we have an opposite phenomena to irrigation. We have a drainage issue here.
Right.
where when you were talking about the aquifer system, and I would assume you were talking about above ground and underground aquifers, here what was probably very extensive marshland, and we actually have five major river systems in this county, things like the Kaskaskia are now a ditch with major sides on it, and most of the intermittent streams don't even exist. They were ditched up 100 years ago. So I was curious, when you were talking about the cleansing of water in a natural system, I didn't know if you meant by, say, riverine ecosystems, mm-hmm. or if you meant through actual passage underground, because I think here in central Illinois, like I said, we have almost the opposite of irrigation.
Right.
Everything's meant to shove the water off the land.
Right, right. Yeah, and it would definitely be the riverine systems do most of the cleansing, which is why the smooth flow of rivers is really important. And again, in so many places around the world now, or almost everywhere, there isn't a river that flows smoothly anymore.
Yeah. And the other question I had, maybe this just goes back to like stuff like mining minerals out of the ground, and people think, you know, they should just be able to go over and, you know, drink water out of a stream. There are some very ancient, efficient technologies that could produce fairly large amounts of clean water. I'm thinking mainly of evaporation, mm-hmm. that you could take salt water or water that, you know, has naturally occurring arsenic or whatever you don't want to drink, mm-hmm. and you could evaporate it very easily underneath glass or plastic to create very efficiently with sunlight huge amounts of fresh water. And I'm curious as to, you know, they talk about at one point the Saudis were going to import icebergs or something like that. And I've just always wondered why people, if they just think of water as free, or why. And so thank you.
Thank you. That gets into the territory of solutions, which would you like me to go into now?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. There are solutions to this crisis that we can begin to look at, and a lot of them are going to be technological solutions. The shipping of water around the world is one thing that certainly is beginning to be considered. And I don't mean through huge pipelines or something like that, but there's actually now barge shipping technology, which carries water in polyurethane bags that look like big sausages, that can actually ship water from one place to another. The Grecian islands I talk about in the book, which have no water on the islands themselves, no fresh water, get all of their water shipped from the mainland, from Greece, by this technology. And again, it's just bags that carry it there. The people there don't even know it. They turn on their tap, they've got water, but the bags just hook up to the supply system, and there it goes. That's one way of doing it. And by the way, Canada has the largest water supply of any place on Earth, and has a very, very tiny population, only 30 million people or so. So with that mismatch of supply and demand, a lot of people feel that Canada will end up being the OPEC of water in the end, because they could sell water to thirsty nations and thirsty places around the world. So that's one possible solution on the drawing boards. The other one is, and the caller alluded to this, is desalination, which is just one part of what he was alluding to, but the main part. And what that simply means is taking ocean water, salt water, obviously, and taking the salt out of it and turning it into fresh water that people can use. That is going to be necessary, and it's going to be a solution that we're going to need to use, because we have so much ocean water, obviously. We have so much more than, only 2.5% of the water on Earth is not salt water. Fresh water is 2.5%, and even most of that's in glaciers, so it makes it hard to get at. So with 98% or so salt water, we're going to have to begin to use the oceans ultimately. Now, Saudi Arabia, by the way, already gets most of its water from desalination plants, but they can afford it because they've got a lot of oil money. Commodity feeds a commodity, mm-hmm. essentially. Poorer nations obviously can't afford doing something like that. And in Southern California, where we've got the money, nobody wants to pay the price of desalinated water. So so the problem is going to have to come down to getting that technology down to a price that water isn't too expensive, but at the same time, properly pricing water in places like the United States so that people actually pay based on supply and demand. If you live in Southern California, where there is no water, there is absolutely no water for use in Los Angeles anymore. The Los Angeles River, which was once a river, is dry. There is no reason why people, the 16 million people that live in the Los Angeles area, the highest concentration of population in the United States, live in the desert. There is no reason why they shouldn't be paying a lot more for water than people in Chicago, the people in New York, you know, people in areas where there are water supplies. And until we sort of sort out that imbalance and stop subsidizing water everywhere, we're not going to be able to develop technologies like desalination.
What about people in places where they can't afford it? Like, for instance, you talk about the globalization of water in the book and a place in Bolivia by the name of Cochabamba. Tell us about that.
Right. Cochabamba is a really interesting story. The people of Cochabamba are poor people. It was a mining community, and the mines have basically left. So there's very little business left there. And this is a sort of typical situation that you see around the world. The Bolivian government is unable to supply clean water to the people of the area. And in fact, Cochabamba is on the base of the Andes. There's lots of water coming off the Andes, so there should be enough clean water there. The problem is the government is corrupt. The government has no money. If you want to pay them off, you'll get water for your hotel or your big home if you're rich. If you're poor, you get nothing. You turn the tap on. 50% of the time, nothing comes out. 20% of that rest of the time, when it does come out, it's dirty. So the Bolivian government has not been delivering water to these people. So they gave up, and as I said earlier, as some places are doing, they turned it over to a private company, to a unit of Bechtel, which is a U.S. company, to take over the water supply and supply water. Well, Bechtel's a profit-making organization, walked in and took the water supply over and proceeded to raise the price of water to the going rate that they felt they should charge, which turned out to be twice what people in Washington, D.C. are paying. Well, obviously the people in Cochabamba could not afford to pay for that. They don't have that kind of money, even those that are working. And so they took to the streets in what I describe in the book really as the first salvo in the water war in the world. And with weapons on both sides, meaning the government trying to defend its side and the people trying to defend themselves, people ended up getting killed. These are riots that went on for like 3 or 4 months, and it ended with Bechtel getting thrown out. The people actually won, but what did they win? They won going back to a situation when they still don't have a clean water supply. However, what they did win was something that's very important around the world right now, as we see this globalization of water, and globalization meaning the privatization of it with private companies from other places coming in and taking over water supplies. What they did win, though, is the right to be a part of the process of deciding who runs their water supply, which private operations run it, and being involved in the discussions of price and being involved in the discussions of providing clean water and who gets the water and that sort of thing. So it became a people's movement that rose up almost like a strike, in the United States might, for instance, where the people became part of the solution and actually became part of sort of the board that's making the decisions now. And that's very valuable as we go forward, because this is going to repeat itself around the world as places and countries are unable to supply water to their people. So one of the solutions that has been brought up, and I talk about this in the book, and let me give credit to Mikhail Gorbachev, who runs Green Cross International. A lot of people don't know what he's doing now, but he is head of Green Cross International, which is an organization that actually solves environmental disputes and focuses a lot of its work on water, because so many environmental disputes are around water. And one of the ideas that he's floating around former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright is floating around, some in the UN are as well, is that we need to look at water as a global issue. It's something we all share as a world. You know, if somebody doesn't have water in Bolivia, it should affect us as much as somebody not having water in Atlanta, because we're all sharing the same resource. And so one answer is, and, you know, this is not going to be incredibly popular here, and isn't incredibly popular here, if you price water accurately in rich nations like the United States, so that, as I said, Southern California would pay a lot more than, let's say, people in your area would, or people, I live on the East Coast, would, but we all would probably pay a little bit more because we're all being subsidized. The money that comes from that, some of it would have to go into a fund to supply water and to subsidize water in nations that don't get water, that can't afford water at a real price. And let me just add one thing about that. This is not just charity, because when people can't get water around the world, it does lead to people being unhappy, people being disenchanted, even potentially terrorism. It leads to people not being able to work, so economies don't develop. It leads to a lot of money being put to health care because you've got to take care of people who are sick because they're not getting enough water. And we're all paying that price as a world. You know, we're paying that price in disputes, as well as, obviously, we support, with foreign aid and so on, places that are suffering in that way. So why not resolve the issue if one of the issues, and one of the main issues, is the supplying of water? So it comes full circle, but it really is a solution that I think people have to begin to think about. Mm.
We have a number of listeners waiting to talk with us. Let's go next to a caller in Urbana on line two. Hi.
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 I have a consumer question, and that is why products for the household aren't more readily available at reasonable cost so that we are all consuming less water as a nation with our dishwashers and washing machines and toilets and showers and what have you.
Yeah, well, that's a very, very important point, and that's the flip side of it, conservation. You know, we don't talk about conservation till we have a drought. I'm sure you've had that in your area. I've had it in mine. You know, when there are droughts, suddenly you can't water the lawn but every other day or something like that, and then suddenly we realize we've got a water problem. People don't think about conservation. And you're right, appliance makers are not being forced to do it. We're dealing with that with cars. We're dealing with that so we don't use as much oil, but nobody seems to want to deal with that when it comes to water. And let me throw out, to me, the most disturbing set of statistics, is that one think tank in the U.S. Came up with the number that people on average need 50 liters per day at least to meet the minimum quality of life. And if you think of 50 liters per day, you know, think of a 2-liter bottle of water, for instance, or of Coca-Cola. Think 25 times that. That is the minimum for quality of life. There are places in the world, many, many countries, probably close to 60 or 70 countries, that are under that number. Places like Haiti get 5 liters per day on average. An individual gets 5 liters per day. That's two of those bottles that I was just talking about. That's one flush of water that, you know, for our flushing is an entire amount of water for a person in Haiti. So obviously, it's actually one quarter of doing the wash. So that's a really important point. Nobody is addressing that issue. That okay, we seem like we have enough water in this country. In many areas we still do, but we're papering it over with subsidizing it, with importing it, with shipping it from one place to another, with great management schemes that are breaking down on us now. And conservation is going to have to be a solution, and it's going to have to start with major things like appliances and plumbing systems.
Let's talk with another listener. I want to thank that caller for her call this afternoon. Next, we're going to go to Eureka, a listener waiting for us on line three.
Thank you. You just touched on my concern. And I guess the question I would have is, what is the per capita water use in the United States and the industrial countries as compared to other parts of the world that don't have enough water?
Mm-hmm. Well, the United States is about, I just talked about 50 liters per day. Mm-hmm. The United States is about 500 liters per day that we use per capita.
I see.
Now, again, but I want to caution on this. you know, just because we're using that doesn't mean we have it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because again, we, you know, Southern California is my favorite poster boy for this. There is no water there. And yet, when you go there, and I'm sure many of you have been there, go to Palm Springs, for instance, it doesn't look like the desert.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, they're watering the lawns all day long. So again, it's a lot of management schemes that we've put together that make it look like we have enough water to use, but we are using much more than the rest of the world is, and you know we're acting like we've got it, and we're acting like we don't have to conserve it.
May I ask one more question, please?
Sure.
If water were to rise to its true rate of, I don't know what you call production, or what the cost of transporting it, say in Southern California, do you have it? Have you done any research on what it might be?
The cost to do
the
that?
Cost, yeah. Maybe number of times what they're paying now.
Yeah, it would be incredibly different. It would if you look at this is now we're talking cubic centimeters, so ignore that part of it. But let's just talk about a number. They're paying about 80 cents per cubic centimeter,
mm-hmm.
and they should be paying more like $15 to $20 per cubic centimeter.
Oh.
I mean, it's a huge imbalance. And again, it's subsidized though because the federal government owns the Colorado River water and is sharing it, you know, and is shipping it over there. We built the Hoover Dam purely for that purpose, to supply Southern California. So it's purely subsidized water.
The same thing would be true of agriculture then in California too, which I understand uses by far the greatest amount of water.
And that's that's one other point to make about that is now because of that. In Southern California and in the valleys, in the San Joaquin Valley, for instance, the farmers, because they have their farm there, have the rights to that water, essentially own that water, even though it's not theirs and it's being subsidized to deliver it to them. A lot of them are not growing crops with that water. They're actually selling it to Los Angeles, to the Metropolitan Water District, because the district's willing to pay more money for it than it would be if they were growing crops and that they'd make from their crops. So selling the water is worth more to them than growing crops. And yet the irony is, of course, it's not their water anyway. I mean, this is an irrigation system that got built for them, and now they seem to have the right to the water so they can sell it. So it's an incredibly complex situation there and in many other places around the country like that.
I want to thank the caller for his call, and we're going to move on to another listener who's waiting for us in Vermilion County in Belgium on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Your topic is amazing, and I have many, many questions and comments about, but I'm sure we don't have time for all of them. One of the most obscene things I notice about Southern California is they don't believe in brooms. They want to take water and squirt off the leaves on their streets when they do not have water. It's just what they do in Southern California with water is obnoxious. But I pay almost nothing for my water. I get my water from what's called the Mahomet Aquifer that Champaign-Urbana gets it from.
Mm-hmm.
I pump it out of a well. Mm-hmm. So the cost to me is just whatever electricity it takes to haul it from the bottom of the hole to the top, which is not much. And what I can't understand is why can't it be more equitably spread around in some interesting sort of ways? Because, like in the Great Lakes, there's a large fight now because we don't really want to send that enormous amount of fresh water someplace else because all the states around it want to control it.
Yep.
You look at the Caspian Sea, mm-hmm. where the Russians have essentially emptied it, and now it's just nothing but just a salt flat to speak of.
Yep.
Also, the Mono Lake in Central California,
yep, sure.
A very sad situation there. Mm-hmm. But as I draw my water out of my well, I'll do it as long as the water's present. But Champaign, which is where this radio station comes from, mm-hmm. Is also on the same aquifer. They have much more water. I'm on the fringe. They're more towards the center.
Mm-hmm.
They start pumping it out. At some point, mine's going to be empty. And so I won't have water anymore.
Right. Well, okay, and see, you've brought up a few interesting points. First of all, the Great Lakes is a very important point, and it relates to your point of you know, you've described a sharing of water situation. And, again, we are not viewing water in the right way. You are, but generally we don't. We don't view water as something that we have to share. So it's, you're right, the person closest to it gets all of it first, then comes the next guy, then the next guy, and by the time it gets the guy at the end, it's a trickle. That's happening more and more because population is growing and there's less water around, as I said, because of development and so on and dams, so it becomes more and more of a trickle at the end. So unless we create management plans and figure out how to supply water to everybody in a way where we've managed it with a cohesive and coherent approach, we're going to keep running into this problem over and over. And you know, the fact that we're discussing all of this today means it's here, and this discussion is going to continue, you know, over the next 5, 10, 15 years, and it's just going to get worse. So that sharing of water is very important. But then come full circle on that. The Great Lakes, you will have to be an area that we're going to be shipping water from because there's a lot of water there. But be assured of one thing. The Canadian-U.S. Authority that control the Great Lakes have put together a paper on how to ship water from the Great Lakes. And it's a really, really good document. I talk about it in my book. And what the document says, just quickly on one point of it that's very important, is that any water that gets pulled out of the Great Lakes needs to be replenished. And after it's replenished, you can pull a certain amount more out. And the water can't drop more than 5% over, I can't remember the exact date, but it's like over a year or two. Those are that document, which I talk about in the book as being this, is a very, very viable, cohesive document on how to manage and share water. And people should read that and understand that, because we're going to have to get down to that level and begin to do that somewhere along the line.
Yeah, and there's another great story in the book that you tell about this situation in California, to go back to California, Cadiz Lake,
yeah,
where taxpayers are going to foot the bill for that, and who knows, the geological survey has said, not such a good idea.
Yeah, well if you're going to, I mean, Cadiz Lake is in the desert, it's in Death Valley, and L.A.'s running out of water, and they're losing some of the Colorado River because the other states are growing that use it. So they want to use the aquifer underneath the desert. And all I can say about that is the aquifer underneath the desert is very fragile, and it's a little bit of water that takes care of whatever plants, cactus and so on, exist in the desert. If you start pulling up that water, you're definitely going to destroy the desert ecology. I can't see any other way around it, and the Geological Survey feels the same way.
Mm. Well, the point that I wanted to make here too is that we have to be savvy about this, because it's going to come out of our pocketbooks one way or the other. This project in California, $1.9, almost $2 billion,
mm-hmm,
a bond issue for this thing.
Yeah, yeah. Ultimately, it does. And again, that's a good example of still where we're just not planning. I mean, instead of them talking about desalination in Southern California and conservation and beginning to say, you may have to pay a little more for water to live here because you've chosen to live in this beautiful climate, but there's no water here except for the Pacific. We need to desalinate, and you're going to have to pay $20 for a cubic centimeter. Instead of that discussion, which never happens down there, by the way, at all, I mean, I spent a lot of time reporting there, you get solutions like, well, we'll just take some water from the aquifer in the desert. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, it still is not the common sense approach and the coherent approach that we really need.
Mm. We're out of time. I had hoped to get to one more caller this afternoon, but we're going to have to say to the caller in Park Forest, our apologies for not being able to take your telephone call this afternoon, but we're just right out of time. Jeffrey, it's really been fascinating. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's been great.
Jeffrey Rothvetter has been our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's a journalist. He is the author of Every Drop for Sale, Our Desperate Battle Over Water in a World About to Run Out.